One title might be The Dharma is Everywhere. And the alternative title might be Why Don't I Find Leonard Cohen Depressing? Or Why Do I Find Sad Poetry Uplifting? Or the third title is We're All Gonna Die, So Let's Just Be Happy Today. So, and yeah, it's really nice to be back in West London. It's a place that, as you were saying, I became a Mitra and made my a real strong and definite decision to take the Dharma as my path in life. And as I say, the theme tonight is something I have reflected on a lot, even before I was a Buddhist, because I've, you know, when you are a fan of people like Leonard Cohen and Virginia Woolf, you get a lot of jip from people. It's like, you know, what's the matter with you? They're sad, they're depressing, gloomy. But the thing is, I don't find them sad, and I find it curious that I don't find them sad. And it was when I became familiar with the teachings of the Buddha that I realised why I don't find them sad. Because actually, and, you know, and I guess when I look back now, the kinds of things that interested me when I was a teenager and onwards, whether it was poetry or music, the kind of things that appealed to me, I must have always been a Buddhist, because, you know, that's one explanation anyway. So what do I mean to the uninitiated of the Leonard Cohen fan club in the first instance? So let me just read you. I mean, the man writes poetry and song, and there's very little between them except the refrains of, they're all common refrains if it's a song. And I was thinking about playing some of these to you tonight, but I think they stand just beautifully if you just say them. There's some strong language in this one. It's called Here It Is. Here is your crown and your seal and rings, and here is your love for all things. Here is your cart and your cardboard and piss, and here is your love for all of this. May everyone live and may everyone die. Hello, my love, and my love, goodbye. Here is your wine and your drunken fall, and here is your love for it all. Here is your sickness, your bed and your pan, and here is your love for the woman, the man. May everyone live and may everyone die. Hello, my love, and my love, goodbye. And here is the night has begun, and here is your death in the heart of your son. And here is the dawn, until death do us part, and here is your death in your daughter's heart. May everyone live and may everyone die. Hello, my love, and my love, goodbye. And it goes on. And it's beautiful. And it's depressing. And it's about death. And I was saying to someone at work yesterday, one of the best moments of my life was going to see this man sing these songs at the O2 just a couple of years ago. And he said to me, oh my God, that's a bit sad. So what, you know, what is it about this that resonates with me? What's it got to do with the Buddha? Well, it's impermanence. Obviously, she says to myself, I'm not saying this, you know, it's just kind of, it's there. It's one of the most central teachings in Buddhism. In fact, it was one of the final things, the final instructions, some might say, that the Buddha gave as he was dying himself. Everything is impermanent, with diligence, with mindfulness, strive on. That's what he said. It's a simple truth that we all know. We, our loved ones, everything we care about will end. And as they say on the box set of 6 Feet Under, another very dharmic piece of modern culture, everything, everyone, everywhere ends. And a more sardonic tone from Mr. Cohen again, a song that's been used a million and one times in lots of different films and sort of different productions. And I heard it the first time in a very strange, dark high school murder mystery called Heathers many years ago. And this was the theme tune, and it's another Cohen song. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows that the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that the boat is leaking. Everybody knows that the captain lied. Everybody's got this broken feeling, like their father or their dog just died. Everybody's talking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. Everybody knows. So why do we need to take these lyrics to heart? Because I do think we've got something important to say. How can they help us to live our lives well? Well, I think if we really took on board the facts of the matter, we would be able to live more generous and more compassionate lives. If we really relished every breath, if we woke up every morning and said, yeah, I'm still here, life would be so much more joyous. And at the same time, if we really appreciated our fears of dying and those of others about the prospect of dying, we would be free to live more honestly and compassionately with each other. How much do we shrink back from conversations about death or sickness or old age? Again, you know, one of the earliest insights of the Buddha was witnessing those things as a young man and realising he had to try and do something about it. I've really, for example, become fonder and fonder of my parents as they get old, and they're getting terribly old. My dad was 91 2 months ago. And the tenderness I feel towards him now, because I can see his frailty and I can almost feel his fear. How can he not be thinking about when he's going to die? Although he clings on to a comment from one of his consultants, he has many consultants that look after him, who said, you'll live to be 100, Joel. He probably will. But my heart opens so much more now when I see the reality of his frailty in front of me and the sort of the tangibleness of his fear. My heart opens when I hear sad songs. Poignant is a beautiful word, and it's what that experience is. It's that tenderness of our frailty and the reality of our impermanence that touches me. And I find it liberating and moving, and it does stimulate compassion in me. There's a Buddhist called Ajahn Chah who I've come across recently through listening to some Joseph Goldstein lectures on the internet, and he once said, if you haven't wept deeply, you haven't begun to meditate. And I think there's something in that about really touching impermanence in your life, and whatever it is that helps inspire that, if it's poetry or song or people's stories, I think it's worth getting in touch with it. It's what makes us human. I'm going to read you another piece of Dharma from an 18th century Tibetan yogi who, again, I just came across a couple of weeks ago, whose name is Shagpar Drukpa Rangdrol, who apparently was a Tibetan yogi at the end of the 18th century. And he wandered from place to place, living a solitary life. And a bit like Milarepa, songs would spontaneously come to him. And I'm not going to sing it, though, again. It's just a poem. So here we go. Another day I went out for some fresh air to a meadow covered with flowers. While singing and remaining in a state of awareness, I noticed among the profusion of flowers spread out before me one particular flower waving gently on its long stem and giving out a sweet fragrance. As it swayed from side to side, I heard this song and the rustle of its petals. Listen to me, mountain dweller. I don't want to hurt your feelings, but in fact, you even lack awareness of impermanence and death, let alone any realisation of emptiness. For those with such awareness, outer phenomena, all teach impermanence and death, and I, the flower, will now give you, the yogi, a bit of helpful advice. As a flower born in a meadow, I enjoy perfect happiness. With my brightly coloured petals in full bloom, surrounded by an eager cloud of bees, I dance gaily, swaying gently in the wind. When a fine rain falls, my petals wrap around me. When the sun shines, I open like a smile. Right now I look well enough, but I won't last long, not at all. Unwelcome frost will dull these vivid colours, till turning brown I wither. Later still, winds, violent and merciless, will tear me apart until I turn to dust. You, hermit, are of the same nature. Surrounded by a host of disciples, you enjoy a fine complexion. Your body of flesh and blood is full of life. When others praise you, you dance with joy. Right now, you look well enough, but you won't last long. Not at all. Unhealthy aging will steal away your healthy vigour. Your hair will whiten and your back will grow bent. When touched by the merciless hands of illness and death, you will leave this world for the next life. Since you, the mountain-roaming hermit, and I, a mountain-born flower, are mountain friends, I have offered you these words of good advice. Then the flower fell silent and remained still. In reply, I sang. Oh, brilliant, exquisite flower, your discourse on impermanence is wonderful indeed. But what shall the two of us do? Is there nothing that can be done? The flower replied, among all the activities of samsara, there is not one that is lasting. Whatever is born will die. Whatever is joined will come apart. Whatever is gathered will disperse. Whatever is high will fall. Having considered this, I resolve not to be attached to these lush meadows. Even now, in the full glory of my display, even as my petals unfold in splendour, you too, while strong and fit, should abandon your clinging, meditate in solitude, seek the pure field of freedom, the great serenity. That's marvellous. And it's all a flower telling all of this, telling us all of this. And I think that's the kind of, for me, the other side of impermanence. It's like, okay, so we have to face the facts of our demise, the demise of everything we know. But that also applies to things in the natural world. But there's another side to that as well, because as everything decays, new things emerge. And beauty moves along in manifesting in lots of different ways. That ever-changing marvellousness that is human existence and nature. It's really sort of, again, as something that I kind of really learned to appreciate when I discovered the Dharma and the Buddhist teachings. I kind of make this joke that I don't think I really understood what the countryside was for until I became a Buddhist. You know, I would go out into it, but it wouldn't affect me. You know, I'd just be like, so when are we going to go to the pub? Would be like the usual sort of backstory I was having with myself when I was out on country walks as a young woman with whoever was the beau of the moment. But now, I mean, it's extraordinary how that's changed. I'm currently experiencing the nearest I think I've ever going to feel to maternal instincts about this gang of enormous sunflowers that are proudly standing in my garden, that I grew from seed. I'm truly astonished by them. They're 6 foot tall. Every time someone comes round to my house, I go, you have to come and see my sunflowers. And they haven't even bloomed yet. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'll be beside myself when that happens. But I'm genuinely full of awe that this little tiny thing put in a bit of soil is now this big. I mean, it's extraordinary. And the changing seasons, which are another example of impermanence, bring huge joy to me. I lived at Dharma Kosha, a retreat centre in Scotland, for 12 months over the four seasons of that glen. And watching the glen change from icy, snowbound stillness in winter to blossom over spring and summer, and then the glorious autumn colours, and the deer sort of shouting in the forests and the mountains, it was just totally amazing. And I wouldn't appreciate any of that if I wasn't in touch with the fragility of it all and the the amazing nature of it constantly changing. Going back to sort of writers and people who I think kind of are in touch with something that is sort of in the nature of existence, I suppose. Another person who I really admire, and again, get quite a lot of confusion from people about why it is I like the woman, is Virginia Woolf. I think she is someone that was very misunderstood. And yes, her novels ramble on and on and on. And she talks about death and suicide, and she herself was a seriously depressed woman and killed herself. But sometimes when I read her novels, I think that her mental suffering was because she really did have some insights into the truth about reality, and pretty much nobody around her could understand that. And, you know, imagine feeling like you read the teachings of the Buddha, but you had no one to talk to about them. Maybe I'm being a bit presumptuous, but I do think there was something about the way she saw the world that was very insightful. And this might not mean it might not work, but I mean, one of my favourite books of hers is The Waves, and I could pretty much sort of open this any page and read something, and I'd be impressed by it. You know, I can't promise that you will be, so this is not random, but I did just open it last night in search of that by the paragraph, and after a few pages, oh, well, that'll do, because that's pretty amazing. This book is essentially the story of a group of people from childhood until old age, but it's not told in episodes and neat stories. It's just the mind conversations of these seven or eight people, and some of their external conversations with each other. So you know about their lives simply by listening to their thoughts and their internal conversations. And this is kind of towards the end of the book. It's just one of the characters thinking. I spoke to that self who has been with me in many tremendous adventures, the faithful man who sits over the fire when everybody has gone to bed, stirring the cinders with a poker, the man who has been so mysteriously and with sudden accretions of being built up in a beech wood, sitting by a willow tree on a bank, leaning over a parapet at Hampton Court. The man who has collected himself in moments of emergency and banged his spoon on the table saying, I will not consent. The self now, as I lean over the gate, looking down over fields rolling in waves of colour beneath me, made no answer. He threw up no opposition. He attempted no phrase. His fist did not form. I waited, I listened, nothing came, nothing. And it just, it's like not getting anywhere, but it's saying so much. And it's just, you know, and I do think she's got a tremendous insight into the human condition. So being human, I guess what I'm saying is, for me, being human is amazing in its sadness and its joy and in its, the relishingness of it that I think is what I hear when I hear some of these songs and read some of these novels. And it's not like, I didn't know whether I was going to do this bit, but I think I am. It's not like I didn't want to sort of get on with it, I'll be sure. A poem that is very sad. And this poem, Paramount, the first person that read this to me was Paramanda. And the interesting thing about this was, so I heard this poem 12 months apart. I heard it on a retreat in September 2004 at Dharma Kosha. I thought, oh my God, that's an amazing poem. And a week later, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And I didn't know anything about that when I heard the poem. And then a year later, I'd been through all of the treatment, I'd come out the other side. I'd really touched impermanence right in the face for 12 months, and I'd come out the other side and I was well and I was happy. In fact, I was happy a lot of the time during the time I was having the treatment. There's something about just letting that amount of fear inside or expressing it, that actually it has to keep dropping away because I found I just couldn't maintain that sense of fear for several days at a time. So a lot of the time I just felt really glad to be alive and really happy. And then a year later, Paramananda came to Croydon and did a day retreat. And then out of the blue, he just read this poem again. And I'd forgotten it. It was like, there I was sitting, having had my tumour removed. And it's relevant, there's references to this. And having survived and got through the other side. And in my head, during the meditation that followed him reading this poem, this little voice said to me, it doesn't matter if you die, it will be okay. And that something happened, something sort of shifted in me then. That was 7 years ago. Touch wood, I'm still well and back in invincible, permanent mode. But the man who wrote this poem saw something and showed me something. It's called Sweetness. Just when it has seemed I couldn't bear one more friend waking with a tumour, one more maniac with a perfect reason. Often a sweetness has come and changed nothing in the world, except the way I stumbled through it. For a while lost in the ignorance of loving someone or something, the world shrunk to mouth size, hand size, and never seeming small. I acknowledge there is no sweetness that doesn't leave a stain, no sweetness that's ever sufficiently sweet. Tonight, a friend called to say his lover was killed in a car he was driving. His voice was low and guttural. He repeated what he needed to repeat, and I repeated the one or two words we have for such grief, until we were speaking only in tones. Often a sweetness comes, as if on loan, stays just long enough to make sense of what it means to be alive, and then returns to its dark source. As for me, I don't care where it's been or what bitter road it's travelled to come so far to taste so good.